we should probably study this in some way, is that a lot of kids who grow up in those kinds of homes, sort of like they want to express their frustration and their brokenness through art. And that's what we see. I can't remember the song, but I remember it was very compelling. And maybe some of you know the rapper Eminem, are familiar with him. Phil, do you know what song I'm talking about where he depicts the relationship with his father and his mother in that video? It's been a while. You remember that song? You're just listening to it the other day, yeah. Yeah. So, but I mean, when you see the video, he's basically giving the biography of his life through the video. And it's very compelling. Now, there isn't a song that I can think of that I would want Eminem to be playing in my house, okay, on a regular basis, right? But it's interesting to me. It's interesting to me that a lot of what we see in places like MTV, that they are producing songs and videos that sort of are biographies of their experiences in life. And so when you look at it, sometimes it's very disturbing, and it's disturbing because it runs counter to God's ideal of what the family should be. You follow me here? Okay. And so those videos become didactic. They become teaching. They purvey the sense of this is normal. And that's not what we want people, that's not the message we want people to get. It shouldn't be normal.
Richard, it's called role model.
Role model. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay. So if you're adventuresome and you want to see what I'm talking about, then bring up online a YouTube or something like that. You may not, but I'm just saying if you want my words to be verified, it's there. Okay. So, and I know some people get a little frustrated with me sometimes because I may recommend something, may have some swear words, or whatever. I study culture. That's what I do. And you try and study culture without running into anything like that. Okay. So much of what I try to bring to the pulpit is this is biblical truth. This is the world that we live in. So how do we reconcile these two things? How do we make it work? So in any case, I'm just trying to give a little background to that. Higher education. The nuclear traditional family is an unbelievable assault in higher education. People like me are the problem, is what scholars and professors are saying. Yep. Yep.
Can you explain to me when you use the word nuclear?
Yeah.
How do you mean that?
Nuclear in a sense that there's this nucleus of the father, mother, children. That's the nucleus.
Okay.
The center. So you have the nuclear family, and then you have the extended family, like parents, cousins, aunts, uncles, and things like that. Yeah. Yeah, good. I'm glad you asked. So the patriarchy is the problem, and I represent the patriarchy, right? And so our children, it depends on the institution, but our children are inundated with teaching that the nuclear family, as led by the patriarchy, people like me, are the problem in our culture. Eliminate that and you fix things. So in any case, as a church, we have to resist this. And we have to resist it not only in terms of our discussion, in terms of our intellect, but we have to resist it as much as possible in terms of our example. So you heard me say before, divorce is not God's ideal. But I will say to you, sometimes divorce is necessary. I counsel women who are being abused by their husbands, you need to leave him. If there's any way that you can reconcile that, great. I mean, if he repents, if he gets counseling, and if he stops, then maybe you need to rethink things. But if that's not who he is, I don't think that you should be placing your health and life in danger, at risk, in that kind of way. So If a spouse anymore, it's a spouse, not just the husband, but if a spouse is a danger to their children, then you are obligated to protect your children from your spouse. They're defenseless. You have to defend the defenseless. So there are always, you know, there are always those kinds of things. But as an ideal, God wants us to be committed to each other in such a way that we minimize the possibility of divorce in every conceivable manner. But sometimes you can't always do that. You can't always control what your spouse does or doesn't do. You can't always do that. And so, but when that happens then, and there are children, then we're obligated to do whatever we have to protect our children, provide for them. And I would say this, and you've heard me, if you get interested in another person and you've divorced on biblical grounds and you are interested in another person, you have to make sure that person can love your children the way that you love them. Because if they can't love your children the way that you love them, then it becomes a point of contention. And my wife, we hear about this all the time. She works with some people where it's disturbing. Damages them. It really does. Your children do not want to be caught in a thing where they feel like they have to compete for your love or attention, or they have to overtly depend on you for your protection or whatever. All that should, so when there's a second marriage, there should be a nuclear dynamic. Does this make sense to you? And when that happens, and look, and you can't always ferret that out. I know it's difficult, it's painful, and I'm not trying to make this painful for anybody, but I'm just saying the stakes are so high. The stakes are so high that we have to. So, you know, again, as a pastor and as a youth pastor, I've been stunned so many times by the willy-nilly way with which people get involved with each other and get married. And it's like, well, if it doesn't work out, we can always get divorced. But what if you have kids or what? Come on. You know, is this person really worthy of your life? And all that you are, don't settle. Set a high bar. There's a lot of low bars out there. Don't settle. Yeah, Al.
You know, one thing you always hear, I know you're familiar with doing it, is counseling for people that are wanting to get married. But you never hear about counseling for people that are getting married for the second time.
Yeah.
Yeah. How they get along with the other person.
Yeah, I often do that, and I know some churches here that do that as well. I know St. Stephen's had a program, I think they called Fresh Start, and it was for people who had been divorced, and you know, and I think they had a lot of success with that. I think that they had people in place that really knew how to work through the dynamics there. So now, if you have any questions about what I've just said, please don't assume. I mean, if you have a negative response, don't assume that I'm intentionally being negative. I mean, if you need clarity from me, talk to me. I'm glad to bring clarity to that with you. Okay, I just only have so much time up here to do that. So in Genesis 5, 1 through 2, it says this: In the day that God created man, He made him in His own likeness, male and female He created them and blessed them. And in the day they were created, He called them man. And so it's God's plan then. Let me just say this. It was God's plan to create a male and a female. It was part of His plan. And so as odd as this sounds in our culture today, there are people who will argue with you that there is virtually no difference between males and females. No difference. That any differences that we talk about in our culture, any differences that we talk about, they are social constructs. That we invented them. But originally, males and females were always virtually the same. And they make that argument because they're concerned that one gender is going to have some kind of unique privilege or power over another gender. That happens, but that happens for different reasons other than the fact that we are males and females and that we're different from each other. And because we are different, we bring different elements or aspects to the nuclear family that are necessary, that God intended for us to have. And so I just want to say that this is something that we can never retreat on. And that when we make the argument, as a man, my first instinct is to provide and protect my family. I think Ruth would say, as a woman, her first instinct is to nurture them and to make them feel secure. Would you say that's true, Ruth? So hers is no less important than mine, and mine is no less important than hers. Although there are certain times when hers has more preeminence, necessarily because of circumstances and conditions, than what mine would. And then there are times when mine is more important because of circumstances and situations. But there is this interplay between those two that needs to work itself out in terms of equality when it comes to importance. Does this make sense to everybody?
Yeah, you said a lot there.
I know I did. But one of the things that is one of the boundaries, and I feel this as a man that we need to reestablish is a healthy sense of masculinity. I think masculinity is very much under fire in our culture. Now, and in some cases, you know, I don't know, but you know the machismo thing that many men have, that doesn't do anything for me. You know, most people that I know that are into sort of like the machismo are really insecure people. I'm just talking about a healthy sense of masculinity. This is in general who men are and what men do and those kinds of things. And I think that men need to get better at conveying that with their sons and with their daughters. Our daughters need to know, what is a healthy masculine male like? Because there's a lot of confusion about that. And our sons need to know. So, you know, for those people who have children and they won't name their child anything that's specifically masculine or feminine, they give them gender neutral names. And they won't, and so and we can do this now in certain states where on the birth certificate you pick X. Instead of male or female, you pick X, okay? You don't declare their gender because you want them to find out their gender for themselves. If you think I'm making this up, I'm not. So God created masculinity and God created femininity. Overall, these are not cultural constructs, but are biologically determined. And the good hard science people will tell you that. The pop science people will not. Right? So fathers, I believe, and this is an extension of the Father's Day sermon, have an added and crucial responsibility to establish boundaries of protection and instruction when it comes to masculinity and femininity. We have that responsibility to take the time to teach our children what a healthy masculine male is. And you know what? Remind me of this next year, because I would like to. On Mother's Day, I'd like to spend some time talking about on what a healthy biblical idea of femininity is. I have a colleague at Geneva College who wrote her doctoral thesis on a woman's femininity and her how she values her attractiveness. And I think she did a great job on it. So anyway, maybe next year I can do that. So we have to understand then that the biblical view of family is a foundational building block of society. It is the primary institution for teaching and preparing our children for life. And it is the model for authority and government. And so when we intentionally break down the family, and when we say every construct of the family is as good or better than any other, then we're running counter to how God originally intended the family to be. We have in our culture a problem of pop culture father figures. You can see, you can find that, Jordan, on the way further on down. The problem of pop culture father figures. And I've alluded to this before, but what we can't be is this. We can't be Peter Griffith and we can't be Homer Simpson. Dads, men. We can't be that. As much as they make you laugh, and they do, they are horrible examples of what fathers should be to their children. Awful examples, okay? And let me just say this. The stereotype that they represent didn't come out of a vacuum. Somebody saw elements of these in grown adult men somewhere, and they coalesced them, and they produced these two tragic figures, right? And the problem is that kids will watch this, and they'll go, that's my dad. They'll, you know, that's him. In fact, my two boys did this with a Peter Griffith one when he found a couch in a nuclear waste dump, and he thought he wanted to save it. And so he had his son trying to get the couch out of the nuclear waste dump, and they said that was me. That would not be me. I'm a germaphobe. I would never do something like that. What's that? Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what he's saying. That's what reminded him, yeah. That's how conflicting commands about how to get something done, I guess, was the problem. But we do have other examples, right? I mean, we have people like Tony Dungy and Tim Allen. Now, Tony Dungy's better than Tim Allen, but there's some elements of Tim Allen that I really respect in terms of how he presents himself as a father figure on TV.
He's not a real person, though, right?
He's not a real person.
Oh,
I don't know about him as a real person. I don't know as much about him, but I know that Tony Dungy has had a sterling reputation I know that, right? So there are models out there. And let me just say this, men, there are young men watching you every day. Every day they are watching you. And you may not think that you have much to offer, but I'm telling you, that wherever you go, if you encounter a young man, and especially if that young man does not have much in the way of a father figure, they are watching you. And you would much rather them watch you than watch Peter Griffith and Homer Simpson. And by saying that, I'm also saying that it's in keeping with what happened in the Old Testament and New Testament. That older men took the modeling that they knew that they had very, very responsibly. Very responsibly. So that's why honor was so important in many respects in the Old Testament and New Testament. Because for an older man to lose his honor meant he lost his capacity to model. He lost his authoritative status in the community. And we can't, I don't think we can afford to give that up. When I think of somebody like Rich Etter, for example, walking through his grade school as a principal, and all those young kids looking up to him, and seeing how he relates to them as a healthy, masculine male who can relate to grade school children well, how he works professionally with women. Do you understand how counter that would be to how many of those kids see adult relationships in their home? It's just so vital. And I don't know why, but I guess men tend to think, and they're erroneous by thinking this way. They think that the positive masculine role models are caught rather than taught. And I'm sure that's true, that's partially true. But positive masculine male role models are taught too. It means you take time to interact with your children or with other people to convey a sense of what it means to be a healthy, strong role model as a male. You do it intentionally. And we need to, I think that as a church, as Christians, we should really get much better at that than what we are currently within the church and within the world. Let me just say this too. There is a cult. There is an evolving cultural hatred of maleness in boys. And I'm not overstating it when I say hatred of maleness in boys. We were stunned as our two boys were going up to the grade school system at the difference that they were treated with as opposed to females. We were stunned. And we were stunned by how many young males are drugged so that they can get through the school system. In most cases, they're just being boys. It's the structure of the school system that runs counter to the maleness of the students. It's not just the maleness of the students of kids who are out of control, although some of them are. And we need a better happy medium than what we have there. We just do. And I'm not just saying it in terms of primary and secondary schools. I'm talking about it in higher education as well, that there is almost an expectation that you have to apologize for being male. That, yeah, Dave.
Why do you think that's?
Well, look, there's this thing called, I'm gonna give you a $64 term here. There's this thing called a Hegelian synthesis, okay? And Hegel said that he was a philosopher, Hegelian synthesis. So Hegel said that in culture dynamics that you have what you call thesis. Somebody says something. And then somebody says something in opposition to that, right? Because they don't like it. And then so some people swing the other way. And then some people who heard this, they swing this way. And so what Hegel said is that you need a synthesis. You need to take the best of this and the best of that, and you need to bring them together. It's the Hegelian synthesis, okay? So in any case, I think it's important to critique things like machismo, this overt, sort of intimidating kind of maleness that some men have. Like, if you go to a fitness center, you see it. Right? You see these guys walking around like this. And what's really funny are what I call the male menopause men, you know, who are like, you know, 50 plus, and then they have this little 18, 19, 20-year-old girl that they bring in with them. And like, dude, it's you're not going to reclaim the former glory. It ain't going to happen, okay? But they walk around in their spandex and all that kind of stuff, or their overly cut, you know, like shirts or whatever. You know, and they're trying to convey this sense of machismo. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's a caricature. I mean, it's okay to critique that. You know, there are other more important things. There are other things, I'm sure, about those people that are better and more redemptive than just their ability to have a powerful-looking physique that they want everybody to be impressed by. On the other hand, you know, I think that we need to convey a stronger, more poignant sense of what males in general tend to be. I want to say this too. There are always exceptions. You always have some women who are born who tend to be more masculine, and you have some boys who are born who tend to be more feminine. Biologically, they just tend to be more that way. But it's how we interact with them. It's how we educate them. It's how we deal with them. That's really important. And that we have to be careful we don't inundate them with certain stereotypes that are destructive. But all this requires thoughtfulness. But in a culture that's always time crunched, we don't oftentimes have time for thoughtfulness, to take the time, really. So I think that this exists because to go back to the question, why is this emerging hatred of boys? Because in what's being taught in much of higher education is that men obsessed with power are why the world has the problems that it has. And so if men were less masculine and more feminine, then we probably would do better as a culture and as a world. So in progressivism, one of their values is sameness. Everything has to be the same. So if we can convince both males and females that they're basically the same, then there won't be this competition between the sexes. There are other things associated with that, but that's what I would say off the top of my head. And so, you know, so maybe some of you saw that where Prince Harry's son had a plastic toy gun. Who? Prince William's son. Yeah, he had Prince Harry doesn't have a son yet that we know of. So, but Prince William's son, he was playing with a plastic gun. He was doing what many of us would say what little boys do, right? But you know, Prince William was excoriated over social media for allowing his son to play with what was clearly a very plastic, okay, great big huge orange tip on the front of it, you know, gun. That was too masculine. That was too offensive. That was, you know, yeah. So, and so I'm saying to you as men, us as men, we have a responsibility to convey a healthy sense of what men are and a healthy sense to convey what good feminine characteristics are, to reinforce that. Men who have the machismo thing where they're users of women, every man in here should excoriate that. You should repudiate that. There's nothing more masculine about a man who can sleep with multiple women over a short period. There's just nothing especially masculine about that at all. It's more masculine to care for women, to treat them respectfully. So we just have to get better at that. And so in sort of connected to this, we've all heard of the word that's often used, it's sort of incendiary, called misogyny. Misogyny means a hatred of women, and there's certainly some of that within our culture, and it's wrong, and we as men should repudiate that. But there's also another word called misandry, and misandry is a hatred of men. You never hear about misandry, do you? Right? But believe me, it's there. I've been in higher education. I've been in more than one circumstance where I was experiencing misandry. Just because. I was a guy. Just because. And so it was instructive to me that when I felt like somebody was treating me, I don't want to say hatefully, but disrespectfully because I was a guy, that I should be more sensitive in terms of when I see somebody treating women because of misogyny, right? I found myself with the other shoe on, right? And having to say, okay, well, that's, when I see that, I need to repudiate that. And men need to teach their students, they need to teach their children, they need to teach their grandchildren that that's never acceptable. Misogyny is never acceptable. Now, I guess there's this huge debate about what misogyny really looks like and what, right? Because, because I use a certain word, or because I didn't say hello to a woman in the room first when I walked in, that's not always evidence of misogyny, is it? I mean, so there are those dynamics that we have to sort of figure out. But misandry is also, it can be very evident and blatant, and we should deal with it as men. And we should deal with misandry as well. And frankly, we need our wives and girlfriends and whatever to help defend us when it comes to misandry. Because if we defend ourselves too much, we look like we're being defensive. So it needs to be both. All right. So what I want to jump to just for a few minutes then is I want to just say, well, you know what? I think maybe what I'll do is maybe I'll stop here. Because maybe next week then I can finish up and talk about, because what I did this morning was I tried to finish up the Father's Day sermon and what I wanted to talk about. And I wanted to talk about the importance of the role of the father in the life of the family, that the family is a nuclear family as God created it to be, that the role of the father is vital in terms of how he teaches and instructs his children, his sons, and his daughters, and that there are some prevailing things going on in the culture that is whittling away and eroding these roles that God has given to us, biblically speaking, and that as a church and as individual Christians, everyone here has a responsibility to set these boundaries and to not allow the world to rob us of these timeless principles, these timeless biblical principles when it comes to being a man or a male or a female, and the roles that God has given to us. Now understand that some of those roles change over time, and they should. There are some things that women do today that men did yesterday, and it doesn't mean that they're any less of a woman, and it doesn't mean that they're any less of a man. Those are cultural things. But there are certain roles and there are certain proclivities in both males and females that have been timeless, and we should defend those. So it has to be clear in our mind what it is those things are and exactly what those things need to be that we need to defend, biblically speaking. So if we're not informed, we can't do that. And so the world is getting increasingly more complex in this way, and it requires of everyone in this room to be more thoughtful and more aware so that you can respond intelligently and well to how the world is seeking to get you and I to coerce people like you and me to think like they think rather than our being true to the biblical idea, concepts, and principles of how he created male and female, me, male and female, he created them to be. Does this make sense to everybody? Okay. And so in my lifetime, as far as I'm concerned, I have a responsibility to engage these things. I have a responsibility to teach them. I have a responsibility to be that in terms of my relationship with my wife as a husband, my relationship with my boys as their father, and to their wives, and then to my grandchildren. I have that responsibility. So next week, then, we're going to talk about adult children with adult parents. And just as a precursor, that the fastest growing demographic in our culture right now are the aging baby boomers and their retirement. And the fact that when you get sort of like the full representation of baby boomers who are retired and going into skilled nursing, the amount of impact and financial cost that is going to put upon our culture is enormous. It is huge. And nobody that I know of is saying that we are prepared for that. We are not prepared for it. So for example, Social Security. When Social Security first began, there were 99 people paying into every one person who drew from Social Security. And today, it's almost the exact opposite. 99, when the baby boomers have fully moved into the retirement thing, it'll be like 99 people withdrawing from every one person paying into Social Security. That's exactly right.
They didn't live that long, so maybe you had 5 years, now you're in for 30 years.
Yep, when I was a young man, when a person retired from work, when I was a young man in college, the average man after retirement lived 18 months. That's right.
Yeah.
He lived 18 months after retirement. Today, people like me.
Brock's not retired.
Today, people like me just hang on and hang on and hang on. We just keep sucking from the system, you know? So.
And people don't have many kids.
And people are not having, yeah, so all these things are taking place, so the dynamics are really pretty significant. And so I'm guessing that what's going to happen in the future more and more is what happened when I was a kid. When I would go to grade school, I'd bump into one of my friends. He'd look very sleepy. I'd say, well, what's the matter? He said, I didn't get any sleep last night. Why? Well, my grandpa had to move in last night. We have to share a bedroom, or he took over my bedroom, and he has to stay with us because he can't live by himself anymore. How many of you remember that? Do you remember that at all? Any of you? Yeah. That happened a lot of times when I was growing up. I suspect that we're going to be moving back towards that to a certain degree because of what's happening in our culture in that way. But all that, I'm getting ahead of myself, all that to say is just final word. Remember when I said that when we have children, when we choose to have children, that we choose to suspend a significant amount of what we want and the resources that we have for the benefit of our children. We choose to do that. When we have aging parents who can no longer take care of themselves, the same is almost true. We have a responsibility to attend to our parents in the same kind of a way that we would our children. We have that. And
we don't think about them before they have kids, though. No. They just think it's all fun.
That's exactly right. So we're going to be talking about sandwich. It's called sandwich people is what we're going to be talking about next week. So, yeah.